on Blog Talk Radio, a place where it's all about duty, honor, and country. Today is Monday, August 18th, 2014, and this is Sally Bassa. Thank you for tuning in tonight. The call-in number for the show is 347-857-4364. That's 347-857-4364. Make sure you press 1 if you'd like to speak on the air. That puts you into the host queue, and then I know that you have a question or a comment. If you do not press 1, I will not go to you, and I will let you continue to listen. The other thing is I do have the chat room open. Now, we've had some problems with the chat room in the past, but the last few weeks it has been working, so you're more than welcome to go in there and post comments and questions as well. Now, tonight, tonight we're going to talk about the process of electing a judge. What is it that you think about when you're going to vote and you see all these judges' names or candidates for the judgeships on the ballot, and how many people either totally jump over them or just pick a name they think they recognize or multi-guess, whatever, because voting for a judge to me is a little bit more confusing. So tonight we have a candidate, Gino Feliciani. He is running for the judgeship for the circuit. Let me say this correctly before I there's so many of them out there. Circuit Court Judge Group 37. And he is going to tell us a little bit about why he's running for office. And we're going to talk about things that when you're out there thinking about who you would vote for, what are the kind of questions you should ask the candidate for a judgeship? I mean, it's not quite the same. You don't go out there and ask them what their personal beliefs are on certain issues because they're not supposed to have a position on things. They're supposed to be neutral, so it's not like they are either pro-abortion or pro-life or whatever. They have to be extremely neutral. So you got to ask different types of questions. You got to think about it in a different sense. So I want to talk a little bit about what the process is to vote for the judge and what are the questions and the whole process there, and then, of course, find out what why Gino's deciding to run and those types of things. And this will help, like I said, kind of educate us on what we should be asking these candidates. You just don't ask the same questions as you do a representative or a senator and those kind of things. And then as we go through this process, now I can easily take up 2 hours talking about issues with the law. I spoke with Gino a little bit before the show, and I told him I had my own frustrations with the court here in Central Florida. Not asking for any opinions, I'm not going to get there, but just some frustrations I've had in the process. And I'm like, it's just, we seem to have some flaws in it. What is the rule of law these days? It kind of gets a little bit confusing. And to me, the higher up you go in the food chain when it comes to our political process and the representatives we have, the state of lawlessness just seems to be growing more and more. And so, there's just so many things when it comes to the law and what it means to us today because, you know, people tend to just, like I say, skip over voting on the judges and things like that, and yet they impact so much that happens in our community every day. It's just, I don't think that we give enough credit to the impact of what they do is. And at the same time, I also know it's like, well, how do you vote? I mean, am I going to go through every one of these candidates to see for those who are a judge who are, you know, seeking to be reelected? Do I go out there and see how they've ruled on things? Or in the case with Gino here, he is an assistant state attorney today. Do I go out there and try to see how he's done on his cases? It's a confusing process. So anyway, with that all being said, one last thing I'll mention, and I don't know how much we'll get into it tonight, but if we get a chance, there's been the, as I'm sure most of you have heard, the indictment of Governor Rick Perry. Then there's also been a couple of cases in Dixie County, Florida, and now it's my understanding, I know the ones in Dixie County, Florida are all due to the common law grand jury process, which is a little bit different, and I believe that's also the case with Rick Perry, but I'm not sure. If we have some time, I'd really like to know what Gino thinks about common law grand jury and where that fits in the process today, because it is actually a little bit different. I'm learning more and more about it, but it's just something else that's coming up right now through this legal process and something to talk about. But first things first, we need to talk to Gino and see for him to explain why he's running for office for judgeship, and why would we vote for him. So, welcome, Gino, and tell us all about you.
Okay, thank you for having me on, Sally. My name's Gino Feliciani, and I'm a Florida native, actually an Orlando native. I'm born and raised here. I've been here for 54 years. I just had a birthday a couple weeks ago. In fact, you invited me on your show, but it was my birthday, and I kind of backed out, and you were kind enough to reschedule me. I went to school here locally. I went to Catholic schools here. I went to St. James and Bishop Moore. I went to Valencia and UCF, graduated from those two schools. And I've been a lawyer for 23 years. I went to law school up in Lansing, Michigan, the Thomas Cooley Law School. When I graduated in 91, I got a job as an assistant public defender, which that's an individual that represents indigent clients who've been accused of committing crimes. I did that for about 6 years and tried close to 100 cases. And then I was in private practice for a short bit of time and was recruited by the state attorney's office to go work for them in their sex crimes division. And I started working at the state attorney's office in 97, and I've been there ever since. I've held a number of positions with the state attorney's office. I was in sex crimes initially for about 4 years, and then I was a supervisor in the county court division, which we basically mentor and train new attorneys that are hired in the office. And then I went to a general felony docket. I was a supervisor there, and you try first-degree murder cases and serious felony cases. And then the last 6 years, I've been a sex crimes prosecutor. I've been the division chief in the sex crimes division, handling any kind of case dealing with child abuse or child sexual abuse or adult sexual abuse. Also, a lot of the online crimes like child pornography, internet child exploitation, and those types of things. And I probably tried close to 100 cases as a prosecutor. I was trying to think last night about how many first-degree murder cases I've actually tried. It's somewhere around 15, and three of those cases, the death penalty was imposed. So that's a little bit about me. A little personal background is I'm married for 28 years. My wife's name's Brenda, and we have two adult daughters, Samantha, who's 23. She graduated from FSU almost 2 years ago now, and then Sydney is 18, and she's a sophomore at USF. And my wife was a teacher for many years, but she chose to stay at home and homeschool the girls, so they were both homeschooled.
Excellent. I love to hear more about homeschooling because I'm not real happy with our public school system these days either. But we won't talk about that tonight. That's not the key. But
that would fill up
in
2 hours.
Yeah. Oh, trust me, I can take up 2 hours here easily.
Yeah.
First things first, why did you decide to run for a judgeship? Just seemed like it was the time, or what motivated you to get into this?
I think that's really what it was, Sally. As I said, I've been a lawyer for 23 years, and, I guess about 10 years ago, people, and a lot of criminal defense attorneys came up to me and said, have you ever thought about being a judge? And, I was like, yeah, I thought about it, but I'm not really sure if that's what I want to do because, the idea is the judge is supposed to be the smartest person in the room. That's not always the case. I mean, I'm not saying that, judges aren't smart people, but what I'm saying is the attorney should be actually educating the court because a judge can't know everything. I mean, they need to have a pretty good basis of knowledge, as far as, legal knowledge and that sort of thing, but you can't know everything. So about 10 years ago, people were approaching me, and a lot of it is because the way I treat people, I try to, listen to, even though I'm a prosecuting attorney, I try to listen to both sides, and because really what we're trying to do is, we are seeking justice, but we want to, as a prosecutor, but you want to do the right thing. I mean, you really want to do the right thing. You want to do what's right for the victim. You want to do what's right for the defendant. There are cases where, the defendant really needs to be, for lack of a better term, hammered. And then there are times when, you need to give folks breaks. So I think it's just the way that I dealt with folks, my colleagues and all, that they encouraged me to start thinking about becoming a judge. And then I guess in the last probably 2 to 4 years, I really started thinking about it seriously. And one of the things that I did is I actually spoke to my old boss because he had a policy that if you wanted to run for judge, you had to quit. And so that was one of the reasons why I didn't run a couple of years ago. But then my boss, it was Norm Wolfinger, he retired. And then the new state attorney came in, and he kind of relaxed that policy. So then I really got to thinking about, okay, so I don't have to quit my job and leave the office and separate from the office. So I really started thinking about it, and a lot of people really encouraged me to run. So that's why I decided to run this time.
Okay, well, on that note, we talk about Circuit Court Judge Group 37. What does Group 37
mean? Okay, the reason you get these group numbers is Orange County Circuit Court is comprised of Osceola and Orange counties, okay? And Osceola County has county court judges, and Orange County has county court judges, but there are these circuit court judges. And so if you're a judge in the Ninth Circuit, you can practice, you can sit anywhere in Orange or Osceola. The group number is just the number that's assigned to these particular judges because I believe there are 43 circuit court judges in the Ninth Circuit. So that's your number. So this just happens to be group 37. So there is an incumbent, and he's judge number 37, so that's why it's group 37. So that's why I'm running in group 37. There are actually 4 circuit court races in the Ninth Circuit where the incumbent is being challenged. There's one county court judge in Orange County where the incumbent's being challenged. And then there are 4 open seats in the Ninth Circuit where the judge that presently holds the seat is retiring, so now it's called an open seat, and there are a number of attorneys that are running for those positions, and there's also an open seat in the Orange County Court case, or Orange County Court, where there's a couple of attorneys that are running. So.
And it's all nonpartisan, correct?
It's all nonpartisan, yes. All the judicial races are nonpartisan. That's why, you know, when you asked me to be on the show and we talked about being on the show, you know, I kind of went over this Canon 7, Judicial Canon 7. There's a lot of things that a judge can't discuss, and that's one of the things that you can't discuss is you can't discuss your party affiliation. It's against that. It's a violation of that judicial canon. So, you know, there's a reason for that, and that's why all of these races are nonpartisan. The interesting thing is that in other jurisdictions, though, they are partisan races. I mean, you can run for judge as a Republican. You can run for judge as a Democrat. You can run for judge as an independent. I think Texas, they have party affiliations. They might even have them in some of the northeastern states. But Florida, all judges run nonpartisan.
Yeah, and that's the way I think it should be. It shouldn't, you know, you're not out there you're automatically showing a certain partiality, if you will, when you say that you're of either party, you know, affiliation or any party affiliation. So that, to me, I don't think it should be identified either. So I totally agree with that. The part I do have a little bit of a question or a problem with, and this is me when it comes to nonpartisan races in the primaries. See, I'm of this, when I think of what a primary is, the most basic definition of a primary is supposed to be that narrowing down of the candidates to just the couple who would be on the general ballot. And I happen to think that you shouldn't be electing anybody in a primary. I think the top two, whoever it may be, should be a top two or three, depending on the different races kind of stuff, would be the ones who would be in the general election. So I've never believed in electing people in the primary. But more importantly, here in Orange County, because like the Orange County Commission and these things, positions are also nonpartisan. And in this case, in Orange County, we have 2 referendum items on a primary, which, again,
right,
I don't truly believe in that. You know, everybody needs to vote in the primary. It's too many people think that if they're not associated or affiliated with any party, that they're not supposed to vote in the primary. And I've been quite frustrated that our current supervisor of elections does not promote everybody votes in the primary.
Well, that's an interesting point. You know, last night I was talking to somebody, and he told me he was an independent. So he goes, well, there's really no reason for me to vote. And I said, well, yeah, there is, because there are all these judicial races. As well, you know, there's 10 judicial races in Orange County. Plus, you've got the referendum items, too. The other thing is, you know, we have a lot of people that are coming from to this area from, you know, other parts of our country. They're coming from, like, Puerto Rico, and they don't have primaries there, so it's in Puerto Rico. So it's difficult for some folks that come from, you know, like Puerto Rico, per se, to understand the real importance of the primaries, because that's just something that they don't have over there. So that's why, in the, like, with a lot of the in the Hispanic community, there's low voter turnout in the primary, which is really sad. But quite frankly, there's low voter turnout among all voters. Orange and Osceola, believe it or not, are the two lowest states for, or two lowest counties for voter turnout in the state of Florida, which is interesting because Seminole is one of the highest voter turnout.
That is kind of interesting, and it doesn't surprise me in some respects, because there are so many people who have moved in. But I mean, it's not just Orange County, but you know, we've had such a transient population, which I think is part of it. But I also, when it comes to these primaries, too many people do not know they're supposed to vote in them, and it frustrates me to no end. So I do my best to try to educate people. And on my ballot right here that I'm looking at, I've got a school board member. Now in this particular time. Well, Teresa Jacobs, she's running for Orange County Mayor. Everybody has dropped out, so there's no primary for that, because she's going to just get it. She doesn't have to even run. And then the next election, I would be voting for my Orange County Commissioner, because they're every other, you know, how they switch them. But people just need to know, yes, it's important to vote in the primary.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, you should vote. I mean, every time there's an election, you should vote. I mean, that's just the way it should be. I know my wife and I, every time there's an election, we vote, whether it's for city council. And you've got the city elections that are a different time of year as well. I think they're in March or April or something like that. So we've got all these different dates where we have these elections. But, you know, if it's time to go vote, we go vote. I mean, it doesn't matter when it is, you know what I'm saying? And that's really,
right,
I think,
exactly,
the way everybody should be. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So anyway, so I do my best to tell people, yes, you do vote in the primary. Don't let them tell you that. you vote. Just get out there and vote.
Right.
Anyway, the next thing, going back to when you're trying to decide on who you should vote for the judge. I mean, and I openly admit I'm guilty of this myself. If I haven't heard anything specific about a judge via some kind of news reports, it takes a lot of time to try to figure out, well, who's really the best person for that job. And I'll be honest, in my own case, I typically say, well, if it's the incumbent, depending on how long that incumbent has been there, I typically believe you should kind of keep moving on. I don't think somebody should be in there indefinitely. I've never believed that on the Supreme Court, and that's a whole other story. But you know, what kind of questions should people be asking when you're trying to decide who's going to be the best judge?
Well, there are certain, you know, there are certain questions that you can't, that, you know, if you ask a judge, he's not going to be able to, or a judicial candidate, they're not going to be able to answer. You know, like I said, party affiliation, and then, you know, stances on certain issues. You know, like I heard you talking earlier, but, you know, personal opinions on certain issues, a judge, unfortunately, I guess that's probably a good thing too. Can't express their personal opinions on issues, so you can't run on platforms and that sort of thing. And, you know, you can't ask them about, you know, where are you from and are you a family person? You know, do you go to church? Where do you go to church? That sort of thing. I mean, I've had people ask me that, and I will tell them. You know, you can also, there's lots of resources out there that you can use. For example, you know, the state of Florida has the website, the elections website, and you can go and you can look up the financial disclosures of all the candidates. You can also see who's contributing money to the candidate, how much they've contributed, and so, like, where is this money coming from? Is it coming from an electioneering committee? Is it coming from individual firms? That sort of thing. Is it large sums? Is it small sums? You know, you can use the internet to do some research. Another thing that you can do with, like, sitting judges, of course, is you do have access to the Fifth District Court of Appeals website, and that can be very informative. The Fifth District Court of Appeals is the appellate court that hears all cases coming out of the Ninth Judicial Circuit, okay? So you can go and you can do a search, and you can say, for example, I want to see if this judge is doing a good job. I want to see if this judge, the judge gets reversed a bunch of times, or is this a judge that, you know, although there's appeals, because anybody that's convicted of a crime in Florida, you get an automatic appeal, are they affirmed? So you can see, you know, if a judge is doing a good job on legal issues. And that's something that's available to the general public. There are other websites that you can use, but you'd have to be a lawyer and you'd have to pay for that service. But it's free through the Fifth District Court of Appeals website. So, like I said, you can use that information to see if a sitting judge is a judge that gets reversed a lot, or is this a judge that doesn't get reversed a lot. And I say reversed a lot. If a judge is getting reversed, you know, half a dozen times, five, six times in the course of a year, that's a lot. I mean, you're going to expect the judge is going to get reversed probably a couple of times a year. But if it's more than, you know, say five or six, that's a lot of reversals. And that ends up costing everybody. It costs the taxpayers, it costs the victims, because, you know, if for heaven's sake a case is reversed, you know, then that's justice delayed, and, you know, that saying justice delayed is justice denied. If you could have somebody that was convicted of a crime that should have never been in jail to begin with. So, I mean, it really hurts everybody. It hurts, you know, the taxpayers because it costs money, but it hurts the victims because, you know, they're not getting the finality that they, you know, need. And, you know, sometimes defendants that are convicted, you know, sometimes they're in prison for years and years and only to find out that their conviction is reversed. So, you know, that's something that people can do. There's lots of other resources. I know the League of Women Voters does a questionnaire, and I think most of the judicial candidates, all of them, I think, respond to that. And there's also the Sentinel provided the questionnaires to all the candidates. I think they all responded. I think some of the other news outlets may have done some as well. And then the other thing is it's kind of late right now, but they do have free events. They're judicial forums, and they were hosted by a number of organizations. The Paul Perkins Bar Association had one down in the west part of town, and then there's another group that was called Orange County Political Voice, and they had a free candidate forum that was a couple of weeks ago. And then Guardian Care, which is assisted living facility, again, on the west side of town, they just had one last Sunday. So I think most of the candidate forums are closed now, but a lot of organizations will host candidate or judicial forums, and that's a way where you can go and meet the candidates and have one-on-one time with them and actually find out about their philosophy and that sort of thing, as opposed to specific you know, opinions on certain types of cases.
Yeah, well, I'll tell you, I have to think going out there and seeing who their contributors are, I think makes a big difference. I mean, obviously, small contributions here and there don't really make much of a difference, but if you see some larger contributions coming from certain organizations and stuff like that, you can't help but wonder if it doesn't influence their decision if a case comes before them. And again, I've had my own dealings with the courts lately, and there's been some things that just didn't make any sense to me. And I'll be extremely generic in any of this discussion, not asking for any too much defense.
Yeah, I know. And you talked to me a little bit about your situation, and we had a discussion about that. But I mean, I think it's fair. I mean, it's fair to go online and look and see, and you can see where the money's coming from. And, you know, and that's probably that is the reason why that's all public record. Now, it used to be, right. Used to be that judicial candidates could only accept $500. That was the maximum contribution, but now it's $1,000. But, you know, the thing is if it's $1,000 per individual or per organization. So if you happen to own a business or let's say you own 10 businesses, okay, you could give a judicial candidate $10,000 because you could spread it out amongst your 10 businesses. But again, that's all information that's disclosed. It's all online. And if you go to the division, Board of Division of Elections, you can look up any candidate's the contributions that have been given to them, who's given to them, and then everybody has to fill out a financial disclosure so you can figure out what their assets and that sort of thing. I can tell you that for the most part, I'm funding my campaign. We did raise some contributions, but I'm spending my own money. I don't have a campaign advisor or a campaign consultant. I have some friends that are consulting with me, but I'm the campaign consultant. I'm the guy that's out there, and there's a few other candidates like myself, but I'm the guy that's out there that's putting the signs up in the ground. I'm the guy that went out there and got permission from the property owners to put the signs up. So, and there are other people that are, and that's fine if they've got the money to do it, but they're paying other people to do those types of things. I just don't. I have better things to do with the limited resources that I have to fund my campaign. And so I'm the chief grunt. I'm the candidate, the chief grunt. So, if you know, if you're looking for some humility on the bench, you know, you might want to look at candidates like that. You know, candidates that are out there that are doing all of the legwork, you know, they're doing the heavy lifting. And they're not up on some pedestal, you know what I'm saying? Sometimes that happens. It's called robe-itis. Sometimes that happens. When judges get the robe on, they get this thing called robe-itis. And you kind of forget where you came from. So I've learned a lot of humility during this campaign, let me tell you.
Well, and that kind of brings up, I'm not asking you to bash your opponent or anything, but to be honest, I'm not sure how long he's been in. I know he's the incumbent. I'm not sure how long he's been on the bench right now, but is there anything that you've had a concern about? I'm not asking you to get into too much detail, but I guess I'm trying to say why you might be a stronger candidate than your opponent.
Yeah, well, my opponent's been on the bench for 8 years. He was appointed in 2006 and he ran unopposed in 2008. And I can just tell you that the rationale that went behind my picking this particular group, okay, because there were a number of judges that were up for re-election and there were a number of open seats. And I can tell you that when I was looking at the open seats, there were people that had been somewhat campaigning for like over a year, okay? I mean, a lot of people had put in for some of these open seats and literally had been campaigning for a year. And that's kind of hard, you know, when you're you're really playing catch up when you go into a race where somebody's been running the race for a year. There's a lot to make up there. But what I looked at is, and there's other things that like you can look at online too. There are judicial polls that are conducted by the Central Florida Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers. There are some online forums. One's called the Roving Room. You can look at that. I told you about going to the 5th DCA, and you can look at judges' particular record on appeal and that sort of thing. And I looked at all of those things, and I just felt like this was probably the race for me to be in. I'm not going to say anything negative because that's just not right. The way I am, and I haven't done that. Since I've been in this race, I just tell you that there are things that I looked at. Those are some of the things that I looked at that factor into my decision to run in this particular race. And I felt like after looking at all of those things, and after getting encouraged from a lot of my colleagues, that I know I can do a better job. That's just plain and simple. I just know I can do a better job, and I know that I'm going to treat people. You when you go to court, and I don't know if we talked about this when we talked the other day, but when you're in court, not too many people really want to be in court. Okay, there's only a couple times when it's good to be in court. You know, one would be when you're adopting a child. That's usually a pretty good time to be in court because it's a very
joyous occasion, okay? Or maybe if you had some relative that you didn't even know, some distant relative, and they left you, you know, like, you know, gobs and gobs of money, that might be a good time to go to court. But most time when people are in court, they don't want to be there. They've been a victim of a crime. They've been accused of committing a crime. Maybe you've been a victim of medical malpractice, or maybe you're a doctor that's being sued for malpractice. I mean, it's not a fun place to be. Maybe you're going through a divorce. Now, sometimes that might be a good thing for some people. They might be happy that they're going through them. But generally, it's not a very fun place to be in court. And what you don't want is you don't want a judge to add stress to an already stressful situation. And, you know, I told you a little bit about me in the beginning about being a sex crimes prosecutor. I've been doing that for a long time. And those cases can be very stressful. Those cases can be very emotional. And I think through it all, I think if you were to talk to my colleagues, or, and you know, specifically people that I've had cases against, I think they're going to tell you that at the end of the day, Gino Feliciani has been a fair guy who wants to do the right thing and treated me professionally. Okay, I mean, you can be prosecuting a really bad guy, but you don't have to be a jerk about it. I guess is what I'm saying.
I think that kind of goes to what you were calling it, robe syndrome, or robe something you were calling
robe,
it.
Robitis, yes.
Robitis, yeah, robitis.
Yeah.
I do think some people, they get on that bench too long, and it somehow takes over their put themselves of this nobility kind of thing, and it's like, you're there for a purpose, and your knowledge and your experience is there, but you are not the god of the court routine. So I do think it sometimes goes to some people's heads, and I'm not going to mention anybody specific.
Right.
That wouldn't be in my interest right now to say that either.
Well,
but,
and I think running a campaign, actually, you know, going through the election process, because let's say you have to ask people for help. Okay, I mean, that's, you can't do it all yourself, and you're asking people for help, and you know. I'm very appreciative of the help that I've been given by people. And there's a lot of people that I don't really even know very well that have come forward and have helped me out tremendously. And so, you know, the way I look at it is, I mean, I should be extremely, if I end up winning this, I'm going to be extremely grateful. And the last thing that I want to do is, you know, flip the switch and start, you know, treating people in a bad way. You know what I'm saying? Because this whole process, I mean, like I said, you learn some humility through this whole process, because most people don't like to ask people for help, you know, I mean, and I don't like doing that. I hate doing that. I hate going to a neighbor and asking to borrow something, or, you know, I would much rather just go and pay, you know, for the
right
tool that I need or something, you know, and I think a lot of people, you know, a lot of people that work really hard for a living, you know, they don't like asking people for help, you know what I mean? So
right.
So it does humble you kind of going through this. And it's hard for me to imagine how you can go through that process and then change and then have a level like arrogance or something like that, or that you're better than other people. You know what I mean? I don't see that happening to me. And hopefully, if it starts going that way, some of my friends and my family will tell me to knock it off. And I'm the kind of guy that'll listen to what they say. So.
Well, you know, one thing I was kind of curious about, and this goes to court protocol and those types of things. Now, when I think of the courtroom, I think of it as a public place. It's public record. The times when there's any kind of secrecy or where they block it should be rare to, I would think in the overall scheme of things, should be rare, because, again, it's a public process. If it was a judge that you wanted to see in action, if you will, okay, to go down there and sit in that courtroom and kind of watch how that judge does things, is there any rule that truly prevents a person from going down there and observing the way the judge handles cases one day or something?
No, the only there are very limited instances where a member of the public cannot go and view a court proceeding. Okay, one of the things would be when you asked me a little about these grand juries, that, you know, when a grand jury is convened and when a grand jury hears evidence, that's all done in secret. So that's a member of the public can never watch that, and actually they're not allowed to see what a grand jury discusses. Okay. with respect to a or any other kind of court proceeding, there are very limited situations where a court can field a courtroom. One of those would be if it's a young child that's testifying in a sexual abuse case, a court can have the courtroom sealed, or if there is a confidential informant that, you know, his identity needs to be protected because of retaliation or, you know, his safety. But they're really limited reasons why a court can seal a courtroom. So really, anytime anybody, a member of the public, wanted to go down to the courthouse and watch a trial, they should be able to do that.
Okay. Well, we know what kind of fiasco it was when Casey Anthony was on trial and people were standing out the door and everything else.
That was a little different because everybody wanted to go to that trial, and it was more, and they did, I don't know, did they do a lottery or something like that? I can't remember if they did it for that or they did it. I know in the Zimmerman case they did a lottery where people went down to the supervisor of elections and they filled out their name, and then they did like a lottery and they drew them out of a hat or something like that, and they could go and they could get a seat in the courtroom. But we don't try cases in the Amway Center. Is that what it is, or is it Amway Center now?
Right.
In a basketball arena, right?
Yeah.
We don't try them there. And you probably could have filled that with that, Casey. So, you know, they put it in the biggest courtroom in the courthouse, but still they didn't have enough seats there for everybody, all of the spectators that come in. So, yeah, that's really...
Well, I was personally offended. And, I mean, people laughing and thinking it was like some kind of... I was ashamed of the way that people were acting about it. It was a disgusting thing to me. And needless to say, I didn't go down there trying to watch that. I didn't need to do that. But there was one other thing. But, you know, talking about common law and grand jury and the common law grand jury, people's grand jury, there seems to be a lot coming up right now in reference to the common law grand jury and how it's I'm definitely not the expert on it, and maybe if some other people might have any questions on it, they're more than welcome to call in. And again, the number is 347-857-4364. Press 1 if you want to speak on the air. But in Dixie County, Florida, it was last week, there were two different cases that were created, and I don't know if you call them indictments. I'm not the legal guru on this, where they... the common law grand jury actually indicted someone on the school board. It went after the school board for Common Core and then something else. What exactly is the common law grand jury, and how is that different than the other grand jury we hear about?
Well, the common law grand jury, they have no statutory authority. They have no legal authority in the state of Florida. Okay, those would be citizens activist groups that essentially create their own grand jury, and then they choose to indict an individual. They have absolutely no legal foundation or authority in the state of Florida. And a grand jury is different. I mean, a regular grand jury is that's convened by the state attorneys in the various judicial circuits. There's 20 judicial circuits. And depending on where the judicial circuit is located, there could be more than one grand jury. For example, in the 18th Judicial Circuit, there's Brevard and Seminole counties. There's a grand jury for Seminole County. There's a grand jury for Brevard County. In Orange and Osceola, I believe they do it the same way. There's going to be a grand jury in Osceola, and there's going to be a grand jury in Orange County. And those are convened by the state attorneys in those particular jurisdictions, and then they're typically for 6 months. And usually the kind of cases that a grand jury that's convened by the state of Florida, as opposed to this common law grand jury, they're only going to hear, for the most part, first-degree murder cases, because in the state of Florida, you can only charge first-degree murder cases through an indictment. And basically what that is, and you got to forgive me, I haven't worked with the grand jury very much, so I don't know all of the technicalities with that. I mean, I have presented cases before a grand jury, but I was not the lead attorney. I had our intake attorney from our office that would be the one that would have been handling the grand jury. But I believe there's usually over 20 folks on the grand jury. It's either 24 or 26. And they have to have a quorum, so there's got to be a certain number of them that can actually convene for the grand jury. And then basically what they do is they listen to the evidence that's presented, and they make a determination if there's probable cause to go forward. And for all probable cause is there substantial likelihood that a crime was committed by the defendant. Now, as I said, in Florida, in order to be charged with first-degree murder, it has to be by an indictment. So in the state of Florida, if you want to charge somebody with first-degree murder, the state attorney, in whatever jurisdiction that what it is in, would convene a grand jury. It calls some witnesses. Typically, it's your lead homicide investigator. It might be your medical examiner. It could be, you know, maybe an eyewitness or something like that. And then based upon that determination, the grand jury would make a finding if there's probable cause to support the charge of first-degree murder. And then that would be an indictment. And the only difference between an indictment and what's called the other charging document is an information, is that a grand jury issues an indictment, and a regular state attorney or assistant state attorney can issue an information. So anything other than first-degree murder can be charged by information. Now, sometimes what will happen is in cases that don't involve first-degree murder, let's say if it's a public official that's charged with some corruption or something like that, what may happen is the state attorney in whatever jurisdiction they may be in may want to go ahead and convene a grand jury just because they don't want the public to believe that this is some kind of politically motivated charging thing. You see what I'm saying? Because uh-huh. they, you know, sometimes you know the public might think, oh well, the state attorney only charges person because, you know, if the state attorney is a Republican and this other person, you know, this public official is a Democrat, this guy's going after all the Democrats. Or you reverse the roles. You know, maybe the state attorney is a Democrat, the public official is a Republican. So in order to, you know, not have any kind of an appearance of impropriety or bias, you might need a grand jury to go ahead and make a determination: is there probable cause to go ahead and charge this person of a crime? And if you recall, in the George Zimmerman case, Norm Wolfinger, who was the state attorney, was in the process of convening a grand jury to make a determination as to what charge, if any, Zimmerman should have been charged with. Because, and the reason for that was, I'm not a mind reader, but I think the reason for that would have been because I don't think the state attorney wanted to, you know, have the appearance that he was, you know, trying to placate the public or trying to, you know, cower to public pressure to charge or not charge. And so that's why a grand jury was convened. And then ultimately the case was removed. But you do see grand juries from time to time here in Florida for other charges than first-degree murder cases. In some jurisdictions, I think like Massachusetts, a colleague of mine just got a job in Alabama, I think all of their felonies have to be charged by indictment, so they have to go to a grand jury. So, but these common law grand juries, they have no legal authority in the state of Florida.
Interesting, because I thought that was all changing. I thought there was something else going on with that, just like this thing in Dixie County, excuse me, which was just last week. And when it came to Texas, I thought they kept saying it was a special grand jury. They didn't say common law grand jury, but something about some special grand jury that they kept saying in Texas, which I thought was all part of the same
grand jury. Well, and that could be. You remember in that, I mean, this is really a long time ago, the Ramsey case, JonBenet Ramsey, and they had a special prosecutor that was appointed. So right. I mean, they might have special grand juries in the state of Texas where again, it might be because the fear could be that you're going to indict somebody from a particular county in the state of Texas, so you get a grand jury from another part of the state that hears the evidence, so that there's, again, no argument can be made that this is politically motivated or that you know, these grand jurors were biased or prejudiced against this particular person because they lived in the community. So that may be a reason behind that. I don't believe that there are any other states that give any kind of legal validity to common law grand juries. I don't believe there are.
Okay. Well, I've been hearing a lot of talk about them lately, and I'll admit I'm not exactly an expert on them, by any means. But this thing that was in Dixie County, like I said, there were two different things that was last week, so it looked like something more was happening with it. But beyond that, the other thing, this has been a pet peeve of mine in the legal process. The expression, a victimless crime. Now, in the most technical sense of the definition of crime, can there be a crime if there's no victim? So is there really such a thing as a victimless crime? If there was a crime,
yeah,
there was a victim.
Well, I think when you're talking about victimless crimes, or when people use that term, victimless crimes, what kind of comes to mind to me would be most of your drug crimes, okay? So the sale of a controlled substance, or the purchase of a controlled substance, because typically what happens if it's a sale of, let's say it's cocaine or something like that, that's because the person that's actually purchasing it is a police officer, undercover police officer. So technically there's no victim. That police officer is not going to be a victim of a crime. But really, I think you bring a good point, is the fact that even though there's no per se victim, there is a victim, because isn't society a victim of even some of these drug crimes? You know what I mean? Because
right,
you know, it's taking away resources, you know, that can be used for other things. So although under the really the strict construction of a statute, there really isn't a victim. Society is a victim. There would be very few cases where there would be, you know, victimless crimes. I think the only thing that really kind of comes to mind would be, a drug case. Perhaps the argument could be made, like, so all these traffic offenses, like if you're driving on a suspended license or something like that, or DUI, where there's not been an accident or somebody's been injured, somebody could classify that as a victimless crime, because under the statute there is no victim. But I mean, society is victimized by people who commit those kinds of crimes, because that's why our insurance rates are so high. You know what I mean? It's to protect us from people who break those kind of laws. So I think there's only very few crimes where you could actually say it would be technically victimless crimes.
Well, here's where I've had a pet peeve on the victimless crime thing. Time and time again, when they talk about credit card fraud and identity theft, the attitude that I have seen from the local judicial process, and this isn't just local, but it's at a nationwide level as well, that they don't go after the identity theft. Even when you can prove identity theft, when you can prove notary fraud is another one. When the proof is all there, there seems to be, from the law enforcement side, and I don't know whether it's the state attorney who's doing this, whether it's the sheriff, whoever's promoting this whole process, who's the driver of it, they don't want to be bothered because they say it's a victimless crime. And I'm like, there is no big, in Florida, for example, and this is because of some of my recent experience, Florida is number one in identity theft in the country. And when you go and you hand deliver the proof of the identity theft, almost nothing gets done about it. Notary
right.
fraud, which plays into that too. You go and hand deliver all the facts and the state doesn't want to do anything about it. It just frustrates me to no end because they act like it's a victimless crime.
Yeah, I see your point, and I would have an issue with that, because yes, there is a victim. I mean, the person whose identity was stolen is the victim of this crime, and as we all know, that can wreak havoc on that person's credit history, their employment. They're very serious. I think really,
what's going on is not so much that it may be victimless as much as there seems to be a real distinction between, per se, like property crimes as opposed to personal crimes or crimes of violence. And that may be where some of this is kind of, you're getting a little bit of this, I guess resistance would be the word that not really wanting to take that seriously. But, you know, they're serious. I mean, again, these property crimes, they cost everybody. They cost you and me. They cost you when you go to the store. I mean, if you shop at Dillard's and Dillard's is getting, $5,000 worth of merchandise that's stolen from them every week, you know, they're not just going to eat that cost. They're going to pass it on to the consumer. So their markup's going to be more. So, I think perhaps what it is it's just an attitude towards people who commit property crimes as opposed to people who commit, like, persons crimes. And, typically what happens, there is a progression. I mean, you commit a property crime, and then there is a progression. Just like if you talk to a lot of these experts with respect to, drug abuse, there is a progression. You don't start with using cocaine. You start with something else, and you kind of progress into that. So I think that they should be treated seriously. However, you need to really look at the person that's committed the crime and then make a determination what would be the best resolution and trying to get that person on the right track. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah, exactly. And, I mean, and when I have these discussions with various people, and, I'll leave out any specifics of what I've been dealing with, but I would give the example, it's like, and this goes to another thing I want to kind of talk about, the rule of law and the state of lawlessness that we're in, as I see it. It's like, okay, people take the attitude, okay, the kid stole the candy bar at Walmart or the drugstore or wherever, and they say, well, it's only a candy bar, what's the big deal? And so the kid goes and steals another candy bar. Oh, it's just, the next thing you know, the kid steals a bicycle. No, it's just a bicycle. It was victimless. No harm. Whatever. And then they steal a car next time. It is a progression. When there's absolutely no accountability, when there's no fear of any kind of repercussion, it's like, well, we can steal anything. We can get away with it. We know how to rig the system. We know that because there has been no bloodshed, we know they're not going to do anything about it. And this just seems to be the attitude. And I see this at the various levels in the process, not strictly in the courtroom. I'm talking about the sheriff's department, the police department, whatever, law enforcement. I'm like, okay, so you're law enforcement, but you don't want to enforce the law. What part am I missing here?
Yeah, I can see where that would be frustrating. A lot of it too is, I don't know. I'm not going to ask you how old you are, Sally, but when I went to school, and if you misbehaved at school, you knew you were going to get it 10 times worse when you got home than any kind of trouble that you got in at school. You know what I'm saying?
Right. True.
A lot of what's going on is. You're right. People aren't being held accountable, but you have to look at the person that's committed the crime, and you can't just say, okay, this kid that stole the candy bar, we need to lock him up and put him in jail for a week, if it's a first time offense, you got to look at it and say, okay, well, what are we going to do with this particular person? Let's hopefully we can get him on the right track. But once it becomes a pattern of misconduct, Then there needs to be different things that are done to address that issue. So like with your particular example, I mean, if somebody commits a crime and they don't learn from that and they continue to commit more crimes and more crimes, even though they're so-called property crimes, then at some point, you got to get their attention. And hopefully, when you get their attention, the behavior can be modified. Or it's just a situation where we're not going to be able to modify this particular person's behavior. So essentially what it is we're just going to house them in away from society for whatever period of time that may be, so that we know at least while they're being housed, they're not going to be committing crimes against people out in society. I think what you're saying is that you got these people that probably have a history of committing property crime after property crime after property crime,
And the attitude that you're getting is, it's just a property crime. So what's the big deal?
Well, and
right?
I mean, that's basically it. And then the restitution. This I have never seen the craziness of what they call restitution. Now, I mean, I can understand you're not going to, you know, go out there and be real, giving some kind of restitution for millions of dollars for something that was a matter of $1,000. I mean, there's, you know, using some judgment, and I'm not sure how much judgment a judge is allowed to use, but that's one of my other questions. But when literally this was the comment that was made to me for a restitution hearing, while the courts tend to be lenient and favor the defendant, and when the statement was made to me, I said, what? They're not a defendant. They entered a plea. They admitted they did stuff. They're the criminal. They're not the defendant anymore. They are the criminal. So why are we rewarding the criminal act by refusing to give any restitution to the victim? And the victim, in this case, the victim was not asking for millions of dollars. It was something asking for something reasonable. Should we not make the guilty, the criminal, pay some restitution? But right now, from what I have seen, no, we don't want to penalize criminals. Gosh, we can't do that. I mean, this is the nonsense of what I see today, which gets me totally frustrated with the rule of law and the state of lawlessness, because these people, in one case, the one specifically, kept saying, oh, I don't need to worry about it. They're not going to do anything. I can do this because the state will never do anything about it. And that's their attitude.
Right.
And luckily,
well,
in this particular case, the person did enter a plea. They were cornered, so they are truly now a felon. But when it comes to restitution, they don't want them to pay for their crime.
Well, that's all controlled by statute. And, you know, I'm not so sure about the particular situation that you're talking about. But, you know, the judges should be following the law. And, you know, typically, I mean, the restitution determination is not that difficult. It's the fair market value of the property at the time of the crime. So if it was a theft, then it would be the fair market value of the property at the time of the theft. If the property was destroyed, so it's criminal mischief or something like that, it would be the fair market value of the property at the time that the property was destroyed. So, you know, and typically sometimes judges require, you know, like somebody to come in and testify as to the value. That could be, you know, somebody, let's say if it's a television set, you know, a TV repairman or salesman or something like that. But, you know, also it could be the owner of the property, and you make a determination with respect to what the property is worth based on how old it was, how much you paid for it, was it working, and that sort of thing. And you know, as long as the victim's not being unreasonable, then typically there's not usually a problem with the court ordering restitution. I mean, sometimes, you know, people that have been victims of crime, they'll come in and they'll ask for unreasonable amounts of money. But that's generally not the case. Typically, people just want to be reimbursed for what their out-of-pocket expenses would be. And that there's, like I said, there's a statute that controls restitution. There's a whole process that you go through. And any type of disposition typically includes provision for restitution. So I'm not really sure about specifics in that, but that's something that the other thing is, too, is victims of crime, you know, they are allowed and should be given the opportunity to give input on whatever the sentence is going to be. It doesn't mean that the prosecuting attorney has to do what the victim says, but they should be at least given the opportunity to be given input as to what an appropriate sentence would be. And also the state attorney is required to keep the victim advised of court proceedings and the status of the cases and that sort of thing. So a lot of that can be addressed with whoever the prosecutor is. A lot of most state attorney's office now have victim advocates. I think they all have victim advocates that can be addressed through the victim advocates. But generally that's something that can be agreed upon too by the parties, how much the restitution is going to be and how that restitution is going to be paid.
Well, the victim advocacy group, unfortunately, wasn't as helpful as what I was hoping they would be. But I found it when a bureau chief said they always protect the defendant. And I'm like, this isn't a defendant anymore. This is a criminal. Restitution is after the fact. So why are we treating this person as though they're innocent until proven guilty? They've already entered a plea. So it just kind of was, it made no sense to me to make that statement. But yeah, anyway, it's just, this is where the frustration, and I see it as a global thing, and I don't want to get too much into, we're not going to get into what the Supreme Court decisions are. That could be a whole other discussion. Like I said, I could easily talk for 2 hours on this stuff. But when it just seems like there's this general attitude of what the law means. When do you enforce it? What is the penalty for violating it? It just seems to be so out of control these days. And as going back to what you were saying, you know, yeah, when, if you got in trouble at school, you got in more trouble at home. But today, it just doesn't seem to matter. There's no sense of accountability at any level, and it's all the way through the process. And it's very frustrating because you kind of wonder, here, I'm trying to follow the rules, but it doesn't seem like it matters.
Right.
The people who don't follow the rules don't seem to get penalized for it. And this is especially true when you get into more of the public office stuff. But, again, we won't go there. The one other thing that I want to definitely ask, and again, being neutral, just discussing it as a subject matter,
right.
Notary fraud. This goes, again, under what some seem to deem as a victimless crime. And it seems to tell me, does this make sense? Now, what I read in a statute, and I don't ask me to recite the statute number or any of that kind of stuff, but the Florida statute out there someplace says it's illegal to file a fraudulent document. Okay? That makes sense.
Right.
Doesn't seem to be rocket science that you would say that. So you talk about a will, a last will and testament, as a document that someone goes and records at the courthouse for safekeeping. I don't understand why they don't know who filed it. So when somebody goes and files a fraudulent will, there's no accountability because they never even took the name of who filed it. How can that be? How can you file a will, and especially after someone has died? It's not like you're doing it ahead of time for safekeeping, like the individual is doing it. How can you file a will in the public record and not know who filed it?
Well, you know, the thing with wills is wills. There are rules that have to be followed with how a will is executed. Okay, I mean, it has to be witnessed, it has to be notarized, that sort of thing. You have to be of sound mind if you're the person that's whose will it is when you execute the will. So wills don't have to be filed, actually. I mean, they can be filed, but they don't have to be filed. So clerks generally, when you go in to file any paperwork, they don't make a determination as who's filing it. I mean, we file paperwork in our office all the time, and it's taken down by a secretary, and I can tell you our clerk will not know who filed the paperwork. So it's not the actual filing of the document, it's the execution of the document that would be what would be the important aspect of it. And like I said, there are a lot of rules that have to be followed when you execute a will. And so one of the things, it has to be sworn to. And so essentially, if you know, there's only a few people that can issue oaths. One of them is a notary, and those have to be witnessed as well. A will does. So,
well, in this particular case, the notary seal, the stamp on it was fraudulent. It was proven,
okay.
Again, the information has been all proven. The person couldn't have been there in two places at the same time. So it was proven that it was fraudulent. And here it is on file. It's recorded with a fraudulent notary stamp. And yet there's no way to know who filed it. Yet it is, obviously, them filing a fraudulent document was against the law, but because there's no accountability for who filed it, we'll never know who truly filed the fraudulent document.
Right.
We can only speculate on based on the people's names who are on the fraudulent will, but you don't really know who did it. And here, again, it's been totally proven to the state that the state absolutely refuses to do anything about the notary fraud. And that's with a will.
Right. Well,
I don't
get
it.
You know, Yeah. Well, you know, there is a chain of command that you can go through. Sometimes that doesn't always work. You know, there are other folks that you can call. Sometimes you can hire a lawyer. They can maybe get you an audience with whoever you're going to need to see at the particular state attorney's office or attorney general's office or whatever agency would be responsible for, you know, pursuing criminal charges. But, yeah, I understand it's going to be very frustrating. And like you pointed out, it's going to be difficult to prove who the actual person was that committed the crime, right?
Right, exactly. Who actually, I mean, the notary fraud itself, that is a crime. But the state, and even if, because the state had been notified about the questions, I should say, there was a letter of inquiry to go out there and find out whether this was a counterfeit notary stamp or whether the person really did notarize it. Because in the state of Florida, the notaries are not required to keep any record of what they notarize.
Mm-hmm.
There's a recommendation that they keep a journal, but they don't have to. So through the process of doing the state inquiry to find out, was this a counterfeit notary stamp or did the notary do it, the dates and stuff all very much indicate the notary did it. A certain amount of ignorance on the part of the notary trying to talk about intent. But it came down to the wire that it was the notary stamp. The notary stamp had never been stolen and, you know, all these other kind of things that said the notary had to somehow be involved in this. And the state absolutely refused to go after the notary fraud. And, again, this all goes down to a level of lawlessness. What is the rule of law and what is lawlessness? When they suspended the notary, they came back and said, well, and it was an executive order, in lieu of suspending you, you can resign. So that they allowed the person who participated in the crime to resign instead of making sure that this person was on record of having been involved in fraudulent activity. And in all likelihood, I'd be willing to bet this person could go out there today and reapply to be a notary in the state of Florida. We don't seem to think anything. It's a victimless crime. That's the mentality. And when you see it at that kind of level, you just see it across the board with law. And this is why I want to ask, what do you think is the state of the rule of law today and the state of lawlessness in this, whether it be Florida or the whole country, whatever? It just seems like something doesn't make sense anymore.
Well, you know, if you're looking at criminal cases, I mean, the standard of proof is beyond a reasonable doubt, okay? And that's a very high standard. Sometimes, you know, compromises have to be made. And, I'm not really sure what the position would be as far as if this person can become a notary again. But it might be that, I wasn't involved in that case. I can just tell you, you know, I'm trying to, you know, explain why things may have happened a certain way. And it may very well be that whoever had that case came to the realization that if this person relinquishes their notary license, they're never going to be a notary again. And that probably solved the problem because perhaps it was a situation where looking at what evidence they had to present, they felt that there wasn't going to be sufficient evidence to take it to a jury and get a jury to convince a jury that a crime had been committed beyond a reasonable doubt. So it may very well be that they decided to compromise, and one of the things that they really wanted was that this person not be responsible to notarize any other documents. So that's part of the problem with, I don't say part of the problem with our system, but that's the way our system works. I mean, we have a great system. We have the best system in the world. But the burden of proof is extremely high. It's beyond a reasonable doubt, and that's what you want. I mean, you want to be sure when somebody has been charged with a crime, and you want to be sure that they've committed that crime. But, you know, sometimes there's just not going to be sufficient evidence. So that's why compromises are made. So I would think that, your statement about the level of law or the lawlessness, I think, people will look at something and they'll say, well, this guy got arrested for this, but yet again, the state didn't charge him with that. And really, all you need in the state of Florida, all you need in the state of Florida is for somebody to come go to a law enforcement office or state attorney and swear that a crime was committed, and that's really all you need, technically, to charge somebody. But really, the reality of it is if you were going to take that to a jury and just have the statement of one witness with no other evidence to support what that witness said, you probably wouldn't want to be trying that case in court. You know what I'm saying? So sometimes that's just the way cases are. So, you know, you kind of have to, you're bound by what your facts are, what your evidence is, and you got to have to work with them. And so not knowing any specifics about the particular case that you're talking about, you know, a lot of times people just come to the conclusion that it's better to just compromise and we get something out of this as opposed to going to trial and the person gets acquitted and we walk away with nothing.
Yeah, and you know, and I definitely understand that part of it, the beyond a reasonable doubt kind of thing, and that's the way it should be. That's why our system is the best, because it doesn't let the whims of a courtroom or of an individual just make that kind of decision. So I truly do believe that's what it should be. It's not that. It's just in this case, the fact that the notary refused to answer and respond to the state in a timely manner as they were required to by law, that by itself was a violation, and that's why they ended up with the executive order.
Right.
But then on the other side, on the legal side, where it was proven, even by the statement of the notary and then the proof of that the person couldn't have been there and some other things, where it proved that either the notary was very sloppy in looking at the ID, but then there were more than there were people who signed stuff that weren't even there, you know, just different things like that, that the notary should have been forced to at least declare some accountability in reference to the other people that she was dealing with. To me, it was more of a conspiracy to defraud is what it came down to. And the conspiracy to defraud was, well, maybe the notary really was duped in a sense and didn't understand what was going on, or the notary did something thinking that they were helping their friend and didn't realize what the consequences were. And if that was the case, the notary should come clean and said, here's what happened, if in fact they truly were duped in that sense. So
right. That's
the other aspect of it all, because it's been proven beyond any reasonable doubt that it was notary fraud. It truly has on that one.
Right.
Well, anyway, it's just these are the things, and we just there's so many things going on in our country. That's why I say who you vote for a judge, it's much more important than people realize. But it's also very difficult to determine who you vote for.
You want somebody that's going to follow the law and make the tough decisions, you know, when, you know, that are unpopular at times. And you don't want people that are going to, you know, try to make the law fit to whatever their personal opinion or agenda may be. You know, I've been saying this now for a few months now, and the law, it is what it is. And, you know, if you like it, that's one thing. If you don't like it, that's something else, too. But, you know, the place to really voice your displeasure is not in the courtroom. You know, if the law says this, then the court's going to be bound by what the law says, and you should that's the way the court should rule. And you know, I try lots of cases, and that's one of the things that we talk to jurors about when we even are, you know, questioning them if they're going to be on a jury, is, you know, can you follow the law even if you don't like the law or you disagree with it? And if we're asking our jurors to do that, then shouldn't our judges be doing that as well?
Yes, definitely. Definitely. So what made you ever decide to be a lawyer to begin with?
Well, I worked as a paralegal for about 3 years. And when I was working in the firm that I was working in, I had a number of attorneys say, you know, if you like this kind of work, you might want to think about going to law school. And I had gotten married, and my wife was, and I were talking about it, and she said, you know, if you really like doing this, I think you should go to law school. And so, I mean, that's kind of the reason why I went ahead and went to law school. I worked as a paralegal for about 3 years, I liked doing what I was doing. But, you know, when you're paralegal, you're more of a behind-the-scenes person. You can't get in court. You can't stand up. You can't argue. You can't do hearings. You can't do trials. I mean, you can assist, but you're more the behind-the-scenes kind of person. And I really liked what I was doing. So, like I said, I was encouraged by my coworkers and some of the attorneys that I worked with. I was encouraged by my spouse, and I decided, sure, I'll give it a try. And I've really enjoyed it. I've enjoyed practicing law. I've enjoyed being in the courtroom. I've enjoyed, helping both, people that were accused of committing crimes, and also, prosecuting criminals. I've enjoyed doing that. So.
Well, it's interesting in the feeling of doing the right thing. You know, I've always kind of thought, being a public defender. Or a defense attorney, but specifically a public defender, where deep down you may not truly think the person is innocent, but that's not your decision, and you still got to go out there and make sure that the state put the case up. You know, they have to prove beyond reasonable doubt, as we were saying.
Right.
The frustration, it would seem like, if you really felt the person was guilty, it must be a difficult thing to deal with.
Well, we have, like you're talking about rule of law, That's just, that's the way it is. I mean, we have rules. We have rules that we are supposed to follow, okay? And so, really, the defense attorney's job is to make sure, really is to keep everybody honest, is to make sure that everybody played by the rules, okay? I mean, you don't want a situation where if a police officer obtained evidence illegally, or it was, impermissible, then the defense attorney will file a motion and argue the motion, and the judge will make a determination if it was obtained illegally, if that evidence should get suppressed. But that's why I say the defense attorney's job is to keep everybody honest. And, you don't want police officers cutting corners. You want them, want them doing a thorough job. And that's kind of the way I looked at it when I was a defense attorney, is I wanted to make sure, I had clients say, what's your job to get me off? I said, no, it's not my job to get you off. It's my job to make sure that you get a fair trial and that the state followed the rules. Because, a lot of times when they don't follow rules, defendants will be acquitted or the case will get thrown out. So, it's important. It's important because we want people that are doing a good job and are doing the right thing, and we want police officers that are following the law. And, the thing is if they make a mistake, then they're going to learn from their mistake, hopefully, and not make the same mistake again. But, what happens is if we were in a situation where police were just allowed to run roughshod and go to anybody's house that they want to and, just completely ransack the house, and then say, oh, I'm sorry, I made a mistake, I was at the wrong house. I mean, that's not good. We don't want to be living in a police state. We want to be in an environment where, we can feel safe in our home and free from, unnecessary government intrusion.
That part is so true, and that's the job of the defense attorney, public defender, to ensure that it was a proper search and all those kind of things, that they weren't just allowed to, you watch shows like Law and Order, and they make you think about the process, but you don't necessarily think that's the way it is in the real world.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because they show where they get the guys in trouble for illegal searches or whatever else, but at the same time, it really is so critical to the whole process. If we don't have that, what do we have in this society? And then we have, going to that next level. What is the level that the government should be allowed to spy on people, NSA stuff? Where is that fine line? How do they determine who's a terrorist kind of thing? And the role of as a citizen versus anybody else? It's a very complicated process.
Well, exactly. And, you're right, it is a fine line. It's a fine line between, protecting, our government and our society and then too much government intrusion. you know, and I know there was some controversy about these drones and that sort of thing that was, you know, is being used. And at what point are we willing to sacrifice our own personal freedoms for, you know, the protection of our society? And that's really what it's going to come down to. And I really can't express whatever my personal opinions are on that.
I understand that could be
something that comes, you know, that has been in the news a lot lately, and that's something that could come before me if I were, you know, to become a judge.
When you become a judge.
Okay.
Oh yeah, hey, that's the attitude you gotta take.
Well,
hopefully
I got your vote, Sally. So that's I got one down. I gotta get about another 50,000 more. So.
No, it's a complicated process, and I mean, there's just various pieces. Red light cameras. Those things drive me absolutely nuts. Again, I'm not going to ask for an opinion, but I know that I've been at intersections when nobody was in that intersection. I saw the light flash.
Right.
Don't tell me that those things are quite.
Well, I got one of those tickets about 3 or 4 months ago, and I just paid it because it was just I didn't want the hassle. So, you know, but yeah, a lot of people don't like the fact that we have these red light cameras. I mean, you know, there was an issue with they changed the timing on some of these. Because one of the jurisdictions found that if they were giving people too much time, so they were losing revenue, so they gave them a little bit less time or something like that, and so they were increased revenue. I mean, it's the idea again with these red light cameras is not to generate revenue, but it's to promote public safety, right? So if they're having to tweak the time of how long the light is yellow. And that's causing people, not so many people, to run the red light, and they're losing revenues. Then isn't that the whole reason why you have these red light cameras to begin with, right?
Exactly. And most of us, at least in my own case, I will speak, but I know there's many of us who believe it is a revenue generator. And, you know, I personally, when it comes to certain intersections, you know, Curry Ford and Cimarron can be a perfect example, various ones on Colonial Drive. There's just different intersections that we know are high risk. And I truly have no problem if they are monitoring and recording that intersection for activity to see if there's an accident that they would know what happened. I don't, you know, but after so many days, if nothing was reported of any kind of incident there, then you would overwrite the tape. That tape would only be used as evidence if something happened. Not to try to prevent it, because we have found, and I mean, this has been pretty much proven, and I know in my own case, I've almost gotten a whiplash before, when people will slam on the brakes, they're so afraid to run that yellow red light that they're afraid they're going to get a ticket because of the camera now, that they slam on the brakes and they have the bumper, fender bender kind of stuff where someone hits them in the back, and that's where the whiplash routine comes. And I know in my own case, I've hit the brakes faster than I should have because it was one of those camera intersections. And it's like, if I would have kept going and they would have given me a ticket, I would have fought it because there was no way I was running it, but I did slam on the brakes more than I should have, and I could have caused an accident by that, and others do. So it's kind of a crazy process. But I really don't have a problem if they had a camera there recording. In case it was an accident, they could replay what actually happened. Maybe that sounds crazy to some people, but that's kind of the way I think of that one. So let's see. There was something else I was going to ask. We have actually, we have covered an hour and a half already. But and I do appreciate your time on this, and I need to give you a little bit more time to say some other things as far as what your message is to everybody, how they can contact you as well. I did put your website up on the show page.
Yeah, the website is GinoForJudge.com, www.GinoForJudge.com. You know, early voting has started. It started in Osceola County on Monday the 11th, if I'm getting that right. Yep, Monday the 11th. It started in Orange on the 15th, Friday the 15th. So early voting will continue until this coming Sunday, and then it's going to be – then you have like a day off, and then the election is the 26th. You can still request an absentee ballot. I think they're going to be taking those requests until I think Wednesday, and then you know, you have to make sure if you get the absentee that you sign the back, and that it actually is at the supervisor of elections office in either county. If you're in Osceola, you would return it to Osceola. If you're in Orange, in Orange. By 5 o'clock on the 26th, anything after 5 o'clock they won't take. So, you know, if you don't have your absentee ballot by Wednesday, then you probably should just go ahead and do the early voting. I think early voting is pretty light in some areas. There's some areas that are a little bit have a little bit more traffic. We've been at some of the early voting sites since early voting started. And but there are 12 sites throughout Orange County, and so it's really easy to early vote. They're open from 10 a.m. till 7 p.m. And so really, there's again no excuse for you not to go out and vote. And even though it's the primary, but to go out and vote in the primary here. Yeah, you'll find information about me on my website. I'll have endorsements, more personal information about me. I can tell you about some of the cases that I've. Pride throughout my career. I've had a number of high-profile cases that have been in the media. But with respect to donations, I mean, donations can be made online. However, donations, the last day that any of the judicial candidates can accept any donations is August 20th. I think it's 5 or 6 days before the actual election. And then volunteers, yes, we're always looking for volunteers. There's contact information on the website where you can contact me if you want to provide me with information and your willingness to volunteer. We're always looking for people that can go to the polling places and hold signs and that sort of thing. We did canvass a lot of the precincts earlier on when we started the election. We did some in May and June. I'm trying to think if we did any in July, but now it's kind of late to be going out door to door. Most people, have pretty much made up their mind, or a lot of people have already voted. In fact, I was just looking the tallies yesterday. As of yesterday, I think almost 38,000 people had voted in Orange County already. Which is actually pretty good for the primary. So the last election cycle in 2012, I think there were roughly 120 or 125,000 ballots cast. The interesting thing with these judicial races, though, is there's an undervote of about 20%. So about 20% of the people who go in and vote, they'll vote for judges. And part of the reason for that is that, like you said, they don't really know much about these judges. So, this is your time that you can go out and you've still got time. You can educate yourself. You can look at the Florida Division of Elections. You can look there. You can go, if it's a sitting judge, on websites like the Roving Room or some of these judicial polls are online. Central Florida Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers, Orlando Sentinel does endorsements. You can look at the League of Women Voters. They've all done judicial questionnaires, and you can educate yourself that way. You can also, as I said, go on the FIPPCA website, and you can look at a judge's appellate record. You're not going to get percentages, but like I said, if you see a judge that's getting reversed 5 and 6 times a year, that's a lot. That's really too many times to be reversed. I mean, a couple of times, that's a reasonable amount, but 5 or 6. Over the course of, 6, 7, 8 years, you could be looking at 40, 50 cases. That's a lot of cases to get reversed on.
Well, and on that same note, and I mean, I was kind of giving my own input or my own take on some of this, but I don't know that we've got your answer when we've got I'll ask it again if we did actually go over this. Why is it important to pay attention for who you vote for judge? Why is it just as important as who the judges are as the state representative or the board, school board member, et cetera, et cetera? I just don't think people appreciate that role, how it impacts us. So why is it important to know who you vote for a judge?
Well, yeah, a lot of people think, it's not going to affect me, it's not going to affect me. Well, it would affect you. I mean, it will affect you. You know, then you talked about the red line cameras, okay? There was a particular judge in Seminole County that threw out all of the red line cases, so that does affect you, okay? And so, it would be good to know that you're going to elect somebody that, one, knows the law, okay, and two, is going to follow the law. I'm sure whatever judge that was that threw out those red light cases probably knew that he wasn't going to be very popular with a lot of these cities that have red light cameras, okay? But, you know, he took a position and he made a ruling, an unpopular ruling, I would think, based upon what he believed to be what the law said. So, you got to look at it. It is going to affect you, and it's going to affect you in the sense of, you know, you may before that judge, or not that particular judge, but any judge, with respect to some type of family dispute, whether it's, you know, a domestic violence case, or whether it's a divorce, or whether it's child custody, you could own a business, and you could have some kind of labor dispute with your employee, or you could be the victim of theft, employee theft, or a customer coming in and stealing from you. All of those things are, you know, have an effect on you. So yes, it is important that your judges, like I said, know the law and have the guts to follow the law and make the right decision the first time. That's really what you're looking for. You don't want to judge. It's easy to get it right after you've been wrong, right? You make a decision and you find out that you were wrong, okay? And so then the next time you're going to have that same situation, you'll make the right decision. You want the judge that's going to make the right decision the first time, right? So
I should hope so.
Hopefully I answered your question.
because the point is, it's frustrating because people, like, jump over it. And I actually would be kind of interested in some of the stats on that. At the end of the day, when the election is over, what percentage of those people did not vote for any judges? Or how many, I would be kind of interested in those stats. Because, there's ignorance. Some people say, well, if I don't know any better, I'd rather not vote at all. I said, okay, yeah, right. I can appreciate that. You don't, multiple choice isn't really the way to go either. And but did you take any time to attempt to learn any of it, learn something more about them? And that is the confusing part. Granted, it takes a little bit more time to figure that part out. But you are so much you are going to be the victim or the beneficiary of
right.
the type of law enforcement you have, the type of justice you get in your community. And we all pay for it. This goes back to some of these other things with the victimless crime routine. We all pay for it. There is no such thing as a true, right. in the truest sense, there truly is no such thing as a victimless crime. Maybe there was a drunk driver who didn't kill anybody yet, but would you rather stop them before they kill somebody, or are you going to wait till they stop, till they kill somebody?
Yeah.
You know?
I mean, then you can look at, like I said, you can look at the endorsements, and endorsements are good, but the thing is, like, for example, I talked about the Sentinel. The Sentinel, for years, was complaining that nobody runs against judges, okay? A lot of these sitting judges, you know, they don't ever get any opposition. Yet this year, there were a number of sitting judges that got opposition. And in every particular case where they endorsed a candidate, okay, they endorsed the sitting judge, right? They didn't endorse any of the challengers. That was for a race in Lake, Seminole, and the ones here in Orange. So they chose to endorse all of the incumbents. And so it's kind of like, well, all right, well, if you want people to run, you know, then that's great. I mean, there were 25, 30 people that were running for these positions. You need to tell me that there was, of those, like, 20 people who weren't the incumbents, there wasn't one of them that was more qualified than the actual judge that had this, you know, that has the position presently. So, you know, it's difficult when you run against an incumbent because, one, it's hard to get endorsements because a lot of people are afraid that, you know, they don't want to upset a sitting judge. A lot of these things are kind of built in with who's going to endorse the particular sitting judge. So So sometimes those endorsements, you know, they're kind of a double-edged thing. I would just look, you know, you can look at everybody's website and you can see who's endorsing these particular candidates. And, you know, I think if you get a, if you got a fair number, like in my situation, there's a number of law enforcement people that are individual law enforcement people that have endorsed me, although I did get an endorsement from the former director of the Metropolitan Bureau of Investigation here in Orlando. But there's lots of defense attorneys that have endorsed me. So you're looking for a balance, okay, not just particularly one area, yeah, as opposed to, you know, another area. You see what I'm saying? I mean, you know, if it was all criminal defense attorneys that were endorsing me, then you might say, well, gosh, why doesn't he have any law enforcement or prosecutors? As opposed to if it was all, say, prosecutors, then if you're, you know, why doesn't he have the... You're looking for the balance, and you're looking for people that are kind of on both sides that would be endorsing you. So.
Yeah, I mean, it would be kind of suspicious if it's all the public defenders seem to be supporting one. And I do find it interesting, you know, you go down, if you're in the outer circle of downtown, what do you have? Law offices everywhere, right? Which obviously
right.
makes sense. They go to court, they want their office to be close by and all that stuff. But I do find it kind of interesting when I go by different law offices and you see the different signs they have out in front.
Right.
Well, some seem to have one of everything.
They
don't
right.
want to alienate anybody.
They call them trees. So you've been around
yeah.
downtown then? Have you seen a lot of my signs around?
Oh, yes. Well, I have been seeing yours. I've seen a lot of them, and I've definitely seen yours out there, too. And I've seen yours just in my area as well. So, yeah, I have seen them. But
Yep.
And
if you look, I've got businesses, law firms, doctor's offices. I mean, I've got a bunch of different folks that have said, yeah, you can put a sign out there. And so, you know, it's a nice, you know, good, like, representation of the folks that are in the community. You know, it's not just lawyers. It's not just, you know, that sort of thing. It's you know, basically just the folks that I've come into contact with. And the nice thing about going and asking people about the signs, too, is then you get a chance to talk about yourself. And actually, I think I've gotten some votes that way, too. So that's kind of a good thing about that.
Oh,
and when
definitely.
We canvassed neighborhoods, that was good, too. So, you know, a lot of times judicial – and I've worked on other campaigns where we canvassed neighborhoods. And I always thought that it was a very good idea to do that. And so – when I decided to run for judge, that was one of the things that I was going to do, and several judicial candidates have done that. Not all of them have, but I'd say probably about half of them have done that, and it is a good way to connect with folks. And you'd be surprised, you know, when you knock on doors, and I had a number of people tell me this is the first time that anybody that has been running for judge has ever knocked on my door and spoke to me. So I think, you know, the voters really appreciated the fact that we were out there in the community and willing to talk to folks. Again, we're kind of limited
exactly.
with what we can say, but, yeah.
Well, exactly, to even have taken the time, because, again, there's just a certain attitude that most people don't, only those who are engaged in the process are going to have a clue of who to vote for and that kind of stuff. And there does seem to be... I guess I'll call it attitude, I don't know, where it's just like it's a waste of time to go out there and talk to the average voter who doesn't have a clue what's going on in the courtroom and whatever, even though we're all, we all pay the price or the victim or the beneficiary of what happens in that courtroom.
Right,
now, in
right.
the Court 37, Group 37, I should say, Group 37, that is the criminal, correct? Or does it vary?
No, presently right now, it's just that's a general civil seat, and
okay.
that can change. And I know, like, for example, in one of the interviews, I don't know if it's an interview or a questionnaire, but the incumbent has stated that if they win re-election, that what they would like to do would be to transfer up to a criminal position up here in Orange County. But like I said, there. I think we talked about the way the circuits worked here in Orange, and it's pretty much it is really a true circuit here in the Ninth. I mean, you can have it doesn't really matter if you live in Osceola or if you live in Orange. you can work in both counties. And and that's really, it's really kind of a good thing because it gives you exposure to, you know, everybody that's in both counties. It gives you exposure to the legal community in both counties as well. You know, it's interesting to contrast the legal communities, all right? And if you look at it from, like, a population standpoint, Orange County is, I think, roughly around 1.4 million people, maybe 1.3, 1.4 million people. I want to say Osceola is somewhere around, like, 300,000, maybe 300,000 to 400,000. It keeps growing. But the number of lawyers in Osceola County is less than 300, okay? There are over 5,000 lawyers that practice in Orange County. Okay, that's a big difference, right? So, so I mean, if you stayed down in Osceola, you would only be with a small legal community. A lot of the lawyers in Osceola, I think, they'll go into other areas, but they practice, most of them will practice in Osceola or in Orange. A lot of lawyers in Orange, they'll go to other areas. I mean, they may actually branch out pretty far. They may go over to Tampa or Miami or something like that. So, you know, it really is a true circuit in the sense that, you know, if you're the judge, you could be in Orange for a couple of years and you could go down to Osceola for a couple of years. Just like if you were going to be on, you know, criminal, or you're going to be in general civil, or you're going to be in, you know, and you know, half of the cases are civil, half the cases are criminal. But when you look at the civil cases, there are then courts that are in the civil area. Like, for example, marital and family law is civil, so you might have a family law court. You might have dependency that's separate and apart from family law. You know, dependency would be if Department of Children and Family wants to come in and try and remove children from their parents or that sort of thing. So you have that aspect, and that would be, you know, civil in nature. You've got probate. You have contracts litigation. You have real estate, you know, litigation. You have personal injury litigation. So you've got all these little sub-areas in the civil, okay, where you could go into. I have some experience in civil. I don't have a lot of experience in civil, but I have litigation experience in personal injury from a civil side, and then I have some experience in labor and employment and family law because I was in private practice for about 7 months, and I did that. And there is a little bit of a carryover. Like I said, when we do these sex crimes cases, we deal a lot with kids that are in the system in the sense that they've been sheltered and they're in foster care and they're being supervised through the Department of Children and Family. So we do have, I do have some experience dealing with, you know, kids that are in dependency and dealing with the dependency system.
What is the term? What is the term for the judgeships? Is it 4 years or 6 years?
They're 6 years.
Six years.
And so the reason there was the whole 8 years that the incumbent's been on is used to be that they would have judges that would get appointed, and they would have to go run in the next election cycle. So let's say if you got an appointment in the old system, 2011. Okay, let's say you got appointed November 2011, then you have to run in 2012 because that's when the next election is. And they change that so that you can actually be on the bench 3 years before you have to run. So that's why he's been in office for 8 years. So he got appointed, was on the bench for 2 years, then he ran unopposed in 2008, and so now the seat's come up for reelection again. So.
Yeah, I personally don't believe anybody should ever run unopposed on any office. I think any spot, I think there should always be somebody challenging them, if you will. So there was one other thing. I don't know if you'll land in traffic court, but this was just one other quick story, which I thought was kind of interesting, just something else I recently learned, not through personal experience, but through somebody else. A situation. This apparently there was kind of like a known hazard on the road or a known issue with some problems happen on the road, and this person gets a ticket in this area. And, you know, the cop has to give him a ticket because that's what happened. But then there was something about if the officer does not show up at the court, then it gets dismissed.
Right.
And it kind of seemed like because of, in the cases where it's a known problem, that maybe the driver, it's just something that's going to happen out of the nature of the beast, I'll say, is the way the road is constructed or what the issue is, whatever, that it tends to be prone to this kind of accident, or not accident, but incident. Like there's certain places where a stop sign might be in a blind spot and people tend to run the stop sign because they don't see it. Whatever, it was
right.
Something, that type of thing. No accident or anything like that, but the person, they had to get the ticket. But then when they were in court, the officer didn't show up and then they dismiss it. And it's kind of like, well, I have to write this for you, but they never say it. They don't say it's going to go away, but I have to write it up, but then they don't show up.
Right, right. Yeah, fortunately, I won't be doing traffic court because circuit court cases don't handle traffic. That's your county court. And sometimes they're just hearing officers that will do those. So, generally, that's something that's in county court. But, and the interesting thing with traffic is the burden of proof is, I believe it's also by beyond a reasonable doubt. So that's a very high standard as well. But, yeah, if the law enforcement officer that issued the ticket doesn't show up, then typically what happens is the case would be dismissed. And so, you know, he's kind of gotten away with running a red light or speeding or something like that. But, Now, the interesting thing with judges, too, is that used to be the county court judges, their terms were 4 years. And Well, I know it's been within the last 10 years. I don't know exactly when it was, but they changed them from 4 years to 6 years. So now, years ago, circuit judges were 6 years, and county judges were 4. But then I guess the county court judges said, well, hey, if the circuit judges don't have to run that every 6 years, then why should we? So they changed that within the last 10 years. So now all of the judicial terms are for 6 years. And they also, the filing time period is different for judges. They have to file, like this year, we had to file before the first Friday in May, and everybody else was filing sometime in June, the House of Representatives and that sort of thing, or State Senator, that sort of thing. But they have a different filing deadline. And part of the reason for that, too, is so that I guess, it's difficult to be a judge, to be a sitting judge, and have to mount a campaign. So it would give them a little bit more time to kind of get their affairs in order so that they could, set up their docket so that if they needed to go out and campaign, they could. And also the other thing is then you kind of know early on whether or not you're going to have to run or not. So. But, what you're talking about with respect to judges that have been, that were elected without opposition, that's generally the way it works here in Florida. I think there were 215 or maybe 220 judges that were up for re-election this year and in the entire state of Florida. And only 15 out of that over 200 got opposition. And what is that? What
is
7%? So about 7% of the judges will actually get opposition. So essentially, once you get in, it's pretty much you've got the job. And then the other thing is even here's another statistic that I learned. And then of those judges that get challengers, okay, 80% of the incumbents prevail. So I've got a 1 in 5 shot, if you want to believe the statistics, that I will be elected. So those are pretty low. So again, you know, the thing is it's, you're going to get the status quo, and so there's a high percentage that you're going to get the status quo. So that's, again, why it's really important to educate yourself and get out there and vote, because, you know, if you don't like the way things are now, then you need to do something about getting things changed, right?
That's right. Nothing's going to change if you keep the same people in office over in courts
as well,
the judges.
Yeah.
Nothing's going to change. And the other part, I got to get this in there, I meant to mention it earlier when you were talking about the newspapers. Do not go on with it. I'm sorry. Nothing against.
Well,
they didn't
endorse me, so I'm going to follow you that line of reasoning, Sally. Okay.
No, I mean, come on. What is the logic of how they come up with any of that stuff? Most of the time, I don't agree with what their logic is on how they how they decide who they're going to endorse. I'm very suspicious of endorsements of newspapers because of all the other impact. Unfortunately, the grand freedom of the press that we're supposed to have in this country, I don't think it's quite as free as we think it is. I think it's much more controlled by money, advertising, everything, all of the above. So when it comes to that kind of stuff, I don't think the media should be endorsing anybody. They can put the facts out there and they can hold their debates. Of course, what kind of a debate would you have on the jury, on the judgeships? But they should not be out there trying to pick the winners and losers. To me, I'm very suspicious of anybody they pick.
Yeah, well, you know, that's interesting. You talked about the debates. One of the forums that we had was very good. It was they were question and answer, and they didn't tell you what the questions were. Actually, a couple of these were questions. The League of Women Voters wasn't a debate, but they asked you a question, and you didn't know what the question was, so it was kind of a blind, you know, question.
Yeah.
I like the way you've been asking me questions here tonight, because I didn't know any of your questions beforehand. But anyways, and then we had one that
and
was
good.
The,
yeah, it worked.
Yeah, the Paul Perkins Bar Association. They had several questions that they asked each of the candidates, and we did not know what the questions were going to be beforehand, and those are really good, and I enjoyed those. I enjoyed that format the most, and I think that you can get a lot of insight from folks. When you have those kind of situations, like I said, it's a little bit late now. Because a lot of these forums have already been conducted. And so, maybe like the next election cycle, you could get a candidate in maybe in like May or June, and then they can talk about the forums that are going to be coming up. I know in Brevard County, they think they still have a couple of judicial forums that are going to be coming up. But so if you have any listeners in Brevard, they can check, or Seminole, they can check and see. There's several candidates for judge up there too.
Well, excuse me, not to be nosy, but what was the question that the League of Women Voters asked you? What was your question?
You know what? I don't remember that question that they asked me, because we had that lunch in June. I really don't. But the other question that I was asked that I thought was very interesting, because a lot of the stuff that we do, as what I do as prosecutor, you kind of learn by doing. And that's why when you start, typically you start in county court. So if you make a mistake, it's not like you let an axe murderer go. You can make mistakes on the less serious. I don't want to say not serious, but the less serious cases. But the question that I was asked was with respect to like training and experience and education dealing with folks from other cultures. And I haven't really had any training. I talked about the fact that my grandparents were immigrants. Three of my grandparents came over from Italy, and they didn't speak the language. Two of them had sponsors, One of them, my grandfather, actually, he was an Italian who was living in Brazil, so I misspoke. He actually immigrated from Brazil, but he spoke Italian and Portuguese, no English. But he didn't have a sponsor, and he had very little money. But, you know, I can remember them telling me about the struggles and, you know, the prejudice that they were exposed to when they came over. But, you know, you work hard, and you come over here for the American dream because, you know, they came over here for a better way of life. And so I really admired, you know, what they did and what they achieved. And then I talked about, like, my work experience and having to deal with folks from different cultures. And I recall the case that I had where I had a little girl that was a victim of a crime, and it was a sex crimes case and very serious. And her mother was a witness, but her mother didn't speak any English. And so there was going to be a need for for an interpreter to be called. And the community that they're from, not a lot of people speak their language. And so there was a big concern with the dad that, well, if you call in this interpreter, then somehow it's going to, the people in my community are going to find out that my daughter was the victim of this crime, and, you know, the shame that's involved in that. And, you know, and it was really bad. They actually didn't even want to prosecute. And so we worked with them, and we assured them that, you know, look, this is nobody's going to find out about this. We're going to do our best, you know, to make sure that, you know, this isn't going to be broadcast within your community. And you know, we really worked with that family, and you know, they decided to go forward, and the guy ended up as, he's now in prison for 25 years. But That's what I remember talking to them about. I remember that question because that, and the reason I remember that too is that was personal to me in the sense that I, you know, remembered my grandparents and what they went through. And then, you know, you gotta treat people. You don't know what the people that you're going to be seeing as a judge. You don't know what their backgrounds are, okay? And they could have backgrounds right. That are completely different from mine and or yours. And so, you know, the thing is, like I told you about, you know, it's stressful going to court, and you have to be mindful of what these people are going through. And some of these people have been very traumatized, you know, and you got to be also, and it's a real balancing act too, because although you need to be very compassionate and caring and understanding and accommodating to the victims, you also have to balance that with the rights of the accused. Because you don't want to have the accused rights, you know, diminished in any ways. So that was really a personal experience for me, and I shared that, and a lot of people could, you know, get some insight from, you know, who I am, where my heart is, and kind of the kind of person that I am and the kind of judge that I would be.
Well, I'm going to ask you, we're down to 3 minutes. I told you 2 hours would go by fast. The one thing we didn't get into on this show, but hopefully you'll come back again, we can talk about what's happening when it comes to Sharia law in this country. When you talk about different cultures, you really have to talk about some of this stuff too, because this really gets, to me, confusing. When different cultures do believe in certain things, and it's like, but wait a minute, that's totally against what we believe in. And some of it gets extreme when the different things that happened when the girl had sex with the boy before marriage or whatever,
right.
honor killings, as they call them, and things like this. And that just isn't anything to do with what we do here, but that is a major culture thing. So we won't have time to get into that tonight. But that is something I would definitely like to talk to you about at a future point after the election
okay.
when we see how all goes.
So, okay, all right. Be happy to come back, Sally. I really appreciate you having me on.
Well, thank you. This has been a great discussion. I've really enjoyed it, and much more to talk about when it comes to law. And good luck in your election. Good luck in the election. And you've got 30 seconds to put your website out one last time.
Okay, it's my name's Gino Feliciani. I'm running for Circuit Court Judge in the Ninth Circuit, Group 37, and the website is www.ginoforjudge.com, GINO4judge.com.
Excellent. Thank you again so much, and good luck, and we'll be talking to you again.
All right, thanks a lot, Sally. Bye-bye.
Thanks. Thank you. And on that note, everyone, please get out there and vote. Yes, it is your responsibility to vote in the primaries. Everybody votes in the primaries. Don't let them tell you anything different. Get out there and vote. Excuse me. The informed voter never makes the wrong decision. And on that note, God bless America, and good night, everyone.